Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Rick Cushman, sitting in for Randall White. The size and the ferocity of the fires burning in California are staggering and terrifying. The Greek Fire east of Fresno has burned more than 150,000 acres in 5 days, and it created its own weather, which could best be described as a firestorm. The air quality has been at dangerous levels for weeks, so long that the eerie, muted sun in the morning and the gloomy late-night afternoon skies have come to seem almost normal. If this were Lord of the Rings. To get a sense of where things stand and where we might be going, we're going to talk this morning with CAL FIRE Assistant Deputy Director Daniel Berlant and with John Clausen, the Director of Air Quality Science and Planning with the Valley Air District. We're going to start with Daniel Berlant and CAL FIRE, who's on the phone. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning.
So yesterday was a very, very nervous day here in throughout California, but particularly Northern California. What happened? Where do we stand after those winds?
Yesterday, we saw very strong gusty winds across California, and with those significant winds coupled with high temperatures, low humidity, many new fires that have ignited were able to spread rapidly, and some of the existing fires that we have been battling now for well over a month were able to also rapidly grow. And so across California today, we are battling 28 major wildfires, and unfortunately, winds are expected to continue through today.
So we've heard about a couple in particular, some close to us. The Bear Fire in the North Complex in Plumas County seems to have really been one that roared through, and it's now headed, towards the area around Oroville.
Yeah, the Bear Fire, which is part of the North Complex, the U.S. Forest Service has been battling now for a number of weeks, and they've been making really good progress. But under these red flag warning conditions, the winds were able to allow that fire to grow at just an explosive rate moving into Butte County. Now, we were able to put some contingency plans in place, move firefighters into that region, work with the Sheriff's Department to evacuate a number of communities around Lake Oroville. But that fire has now burned into Butte County, and we are actively battling a fire that is in communities of Butte County.
And there are also up in Yuba County, as I understand, that, and there are also evacuations up there.
Yeah, in Yuba County overnight, a new fire ignited off of Marysville Road and Willow Glen Road in Yuba County. Right now, we're estimating that fire is about 1,000 acres. As you mentioned, the Yuba County Sheriff's Department has done a number of evacuations throughout that area. Today, we are actually we already have air resources up in the air flying. Yesterday, with the extremely gusty winds that we had, using our aircraft was just not effective and safe. We were not able to get aircraft up throughout most of the afternoon. The winds were just so strong. One of the challenges when we have these strong winds is that not only is visibility a factor for our pilots, but when you drop retardant on a fire with 50-mile-an-hour winds, the retardant never even makes it to the ground. It dissipates before it's even able to do so.
Right.
And so, unfortunately, we really have to rely on our ground crews during wind events like this.
And, I mean, you guys are clearly not rookies, and if you were at the beginning of this fire season, you're not now. But this just keeps sounding like things that you may never have seen before. I mean, how crazy is this out there? How new is this even to your experienced crews?
You know, California has experienced wildfires throughout its history, well before modern civilization. And for CAL FIRE, you know, we have been battling major fires for well over 100 years. But what we are experiencing now is the fact that our fire seasons are longer. Things are drying out earlier. Our rainy seasons, we're not getting the amount of rain that we need. And even though we've had some rainy years over the past decade, we really are still seeing the effects of drought. Many of the trees are tinder dry. In fact, up in Fresno County, where the Creek Fire has been burning, it's estimated that 80 to 90% of the trees were dead. Because of bark beetle and because of drought, there was significant tree mortality. And so a fire fanned by strong winds, just able to burn at explosive rates.
You know, there's a part of us that starts to wonder, is there anything left to burn, you know, and you start to talk about those things. I mean, how devastating have these fires been to our forests? Is it, you know, from your folks' standpoint, has the damage been massive, or is it just sort of what the natural cycles are?
Well, we are absolutely hitting the record books as far as acres burn and even destruction. This year alone, we have already seen fires burn over 2.5 million acres. That's over a 2,000% increase from last year during the same time period. Now, granted, last year it was not as bad of a fire season as we are now experiencing and as we've experienced in some of the other years in this decade. But just to kind of put it in a perspective, 2.5 million acres compared to the entire state is about 2% or so of our entire state. So while these are massive numbers and incredibly explosive, destructive fires, it's still just a small piece of overall California.
I want to ask you a bit more about the incredibly explosive Creek Fire. You know, when we saw pictures of the clouds and it looked like a nuclear explosion, you know, and there were reports where that it literally created its own firestorm. What happened? How does that happen?
Well, banned by gusty winds, the extremely dry, tinder dry, because of all the dead trees, again, 80 to 90% of those trees being dead, that allows these fires to be explosive, to grow at rates that often some firefighters say they've never seen in their careers. And that's just because, again, it is just so dry that this is able to happen. And that's where trying to evacuate people can be difficult in situations like this. But knowing that we have these conditions, California has invested millions of dollars in fire prevention activities, fuel reductions that help us slow down fires in many cases. And so even though we are seeing this increase, in some communities, these fuel breaks help reduce the severity of the fires, and we need to continue to do more. Adapting to these longer fire seasons, adapting to destructive wildfires is the wave of the future. And again, we're making investments. We're changing our building codes to make sure our homes are more resilient to these types of wildfires. These are going to have to be the things we focus on in the future.
You know, speaking of these longer fire seasons, I mean, for us who are just, you know, listening to it or breathing the air or occasionally fleeing, this feels like it's been going on forever already. Your teams must be exhausted.
Yeah, we have been battling fires week after week now, month after month. Many of our firefighters have gotten little rest, and on some of these big fires, when they ignite, we keep our firefighters on the front lines for several days, getting a little bit of sleep, an hour here and an hour there when it is safe to do so. But we just have to keep battling this fire, and these are battles. We have full, attacks on the ground, over 14,000 firefighters helping to get people evacuated, do rescues, and attack the fire. But then it also, using our air resources, attacking it with helicopters and air tankers. This is a full-out war against these fires.
So as we understand it, the winds are to continue but eventually die down through today. What's the outlook for you folks and for the fires?
Red flag warning remains in effect for much of the state and throughout our region due to those gusty winds and that low humidity. The good news here is that we are expecting those winds to really die down this evening. So those red flag warnings likely will expire, and we'll be able to hopefully return back to seasonal temperatures. But seasonal temperatures with dry conditions still will allow fires to burn, but it will give us an opportunity to hopefully make some headway.
You know, and you folks have been warning with red flag warnings, as have many others, about what a dangerous year this is. Are people listening to those warnings?
We sure hope so. While last month we had hundreds of lightning-sparked fires, and there's nothing you can do to prevent those, 95% of the fires we respond to each year are caused by the activity of people. That means almost every fire is preventable. And so we ask the public's help and hope that the public is doing their part to prevent these fires. But we also need the public's help when a wildfire breaks out in their area. Early evacuation allows them to get into safety, but allows our firefighters to focus on actually battling the fire. In many cases, people wait until it is too late, and then our firefighters have to go into rescue mode, and we're not able to actually battle the wildfire. So we ask that people be prepared. They leave early, but overall, help us prevent these fires from starting in the first place.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time. Daniel Berlant is a Cal Fire Assistant Deputy Director, and for all of us, California, thank you for what you're all doing. And thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks.
Next up, we have John Klassen. He's the Director of Air Quality Science and Planning with the Valley Air District, joining us via Zoom. But first, as a reminder of the danger of our smoky air, this is what Sutter Health pulmonologist Dr. Vanessa Walker said when the fires first broke out only a few weeks ago, which seems like months, which was middle of August.
I'm not afraid of the ash, right? Because that's going to be filtered by your nose, by your mouth. It's going to kind of get stuck in your mucous membranes. What I'm really worried about is when I see very high levels of ash in the air, I know that the very small particles, the super microscopic micron particles that are most damaging to your lungs, those are going to be high. And those are the ones that we want to avoid. So when you see this kind of pollution, you need to stay indoors.
And that's what we've been doing for, it seems like, forever now for so many reasons, but now particularly for the smoke. So, John, first thing, thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Rick. Good to be on here.
Okay. And that was, I'm making sure that we can all hear each other. We're playing with our Zoom, as we often do, everybody does these days. So, John, how bad is our air compared with wildfires in recent years?
Yeah, this is definitely a particularly very, very bad year. As it's been discussed already, we often have fire, smoke from fires throughout the state during this time of the year. We get some impacts in the San Joaquin Valley across the state, which can elevate PM2.5. But what we're seeing here is really exceptional. We haven't seen impacts like this. I would say the last time we saw anything similar to this was in 2008, which was a similar lightning siege kind of event where we had a big storm come over the entire state, a dry lightning storm starting fires all over the state. That happened in 2008. And in that case, we saw a lot of fires across the state. No matter which way the wind was blowing, it was bringing smoke into the San Joaquin Valley, different areas of California. This is very similar. We're in the middle of August. We had another lightning siege event where we had thousands of lightning strikes across California, a dry lightning storm starting hundreds of fires all over the region. And what's been happening over the past few weeks is, of course, those fires have continued to grow, continue to burn. And no matter what really happens with the meteorology, which way the wind is blowing, is continuing to bring smoke into the San Joaquin Valley. And we're seeing concentrations of particulate matter at levels that we haven't seen for historically some of the highest numbers that we've ever seen, but have not seen since 2008.
And you said something about the... I'm sorry, we're getting a little feedback here. You said something about whichever direction the wind blows, it seems like the smoke is coming from. I mean, that seems to be one of the problems, is that right now, no matter what happens, there's a fire that's pouring a lot of smoke into the state. How unusual is that?
Yeah, that is pretty rare. I mean, in other fire season we have, there may be a few fires up in the Sierra Nevada, something up in Northern California, and maybe that's it. And so we would only be impacted in the San Joaquin Valley if the wind was blowing in that particular direction to bring that smoke into the valley. So it is very rare for us to have fires to the east, to the west, to the north, and the south. So no matter which way the wind might be blowing, it's bringing smoke in. And it is pretty rare for this event to happen.
You know, one of the things, and I think for this length of time, I mean, I cannot remember a time in California when we've been literally 3 weeks plus where it felt like you just couldn't go outside. Is this amount of time unusual?
It's definitely unusual. Yeah, certainly. I think it's really a reflection of the amount of fires going on across the state at the same time. With them all starting at the same time, it's very difficult for the resources to be put everywhere to attack these fires and try to get them out as soon as possible. And so they've been burning for longer, I feel, compared to past years when there's just been a handful of fires in the state to deal with at a time. So I know it's been very challenging for firefighters and first responders to try to manage all this. And it's certainly we've had a lot of air quality impacts across the state as a result.
I want to ask a little bit about that air quality. You know, yesterday we were in the 400s for the air quality index, which was hazardous. This morning when I last checked, it was 87 or 67, which is pretty good. And yet the air looks worse today than it did yesterday. And so, just in trying to get a sense for somebody going outside, can you tell from what the air looks like? How do you know, other than, I suppose, pulling out your phone, which is we all do, but how do you know if it's dangerous to be outside?
Yeah, you mentioned yesterday's event. Yeah, I can just comment on that a little bit. And that was a pretty extreme event where we, of course, had wildfire smoke across the state, but we also had somewhat of a high wind event come through, lots of strong winds. Was really a trough going over the state of Nevada that caused some of these high winds coming from the north to the south, and that pushed a lot of smoke down through Sacramento and through into the San Joaquin Valley, combined with blowing dust, which also happened yesterday. As we're at the end of the summer here, things have dried out quite a bit, and so that has blown a lot of that dust also throughout California. So it was a real combination of smoke in that dust that created very, very unhealthy air quality in the region yesterday.
So, and what you...
And today that wind has died down a little bit, so it's not quite as bad. And oftentimes what we see is even though it looks can look very gray and very smoky outside, sometimes that smoke can be overhead and not really at the surface level. So even though it could look bad and you look up in the sky, it looks very gray and smoky. If that smoke isn't at the surface level, you may not see those high readings from different air monitoring stations at the surface.
Got it. So, and lastly, what can people do to protect themselves? I mean, we know that we've been told that the only masks that really work against smoke is the N95s. I mean, is there anything else that folks can do?
N95 is definitely a good mask to have for this sort of situation if you're able to get one. But what we've been telling people through this whole period is definitely try to stay indoors if you can, as much as you can in a filtered environment. Try to change the air filter in your home as frequently as you can, in your vehicle. Don't go outside unless you really have to. Don't be exercising outside. And if you have to go outside, try to limit it as much as you can, because as you know, getting exposed to pollution or particulate matter, people who have asthma, that can cause trigger asthma attacks, aggravate chronic bronchitis, increase risk of heart attack and stroke. So certainly try to limit your time outside. And if you have to be outside, don't be exercising and do your best to take care of yourself.
Okay. Well, that's John Klassen, the Director of Air Quality Science and Planning with the Valley Air District. He was joining us via Zoom, as you can probably tell from some of the feedback. John, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Rick.
You're listening to Inside on Capital Public Radio, your NPR station. Up next, a long conversation about trees.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Rick Cushman, sitting in for Randall White. With forests and wildlands burning all around us, we're going to spend some time today talking about trees. The CZU Lightning Complex fire in the Santa Cruz Mountains that started last month roared through California's oldest state park, Big Basin Redwood Park. So there's so much damage done, it's likely the park will be closed for at least a year. But this is not the first time those ancient redwoods have seen fire. Joanne Kurbavaz is the senior environmental scientist for California State Park's Santa Cruz District. She's joining us today via Zoom, and it looks like from the park or somewhere near the park. And tell us a little bit about the destruction and maybe some hope for the trees. Joanne, welcome to Insight.
Thanks very much. My virtual background for today is actually Butno Redwood State Park, but it illustrates that the fire behavior throughout the parks was quite variable. And in Big Basin State Park, almost the entire park burned, but it burned with varying degrees of intensity.
Well, before we get into that, for folks who haven't been there, can you tell us a little about what Big Basin State Park is like? What's there? What's the environment like?
Big Basin is almost 18,000 acres. So it goes literally from the coastline into the areas of the iconic old growth redwoods up above Boulder Creek in the San Lorenzo Valley. So there's a huge variety of habitats within that area, although it was, of course, established to protect the iconic redwoods.
And how old are those redwoods?
The best we can say, it's difficult to actually age redwoods. They can live up to 2,500 years. But to make things a bit more complex, they reproduce vegetatively. So those 2,000-year-old trees may be on root systems of previous old-growth trees.
Oh, wow. So how bad did the fire affect the park? And what we're hearing about potentially being closed for a year, is that what you know?
We'd like to keep it closed at least for a year. And that's both because the infrastructure has been badly affected, Although the trees might be resistant and resilient, the structures were not. So certainly there's a lot to do before we can reopen and welcome visitors again. It also, I think, is an excellent idea to keep things closed for a while to allow the forest to recover. If we allow people in now, we'd probably have to make some more decisions about trees that would have to be removed to mitigate hazards. If we can allow things to recover, then we have more of an option to leave some of those standing trees.
So, you know, we talk about that a lot, about let's let this forest recover. I mean, what's the cycle of that? How does it happen?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, again, there's a variety of impacts depending both on the location of the forest, where it is topographically, how moist it is, how dry it is, and what the species composition is. So that's a very broad question. We do know that these trees in these forests are ancient. We know that redwoods have been in California on an order of 3 million years, more or less, from the fossil record and from evidence of looking at existing plants. So we know they've faced cycles of disturbance and recovery, but those, it's probably not fair to call it a cycle. Things are fairly stochastic. There's a huge amount of change and a huge range of forces that these plants have faced.
So the redwood trees, the ancient redwoods or the old growth redwoods, as I understand it, are somewhat fire resistant. Could you talk a little bit about that and how well or if these trees weathered this last fire?
Sure. There are really two different things going on. One is resistance, which is the ability to persist in the face of these disturbances. And redwoods can resist a disturbance like fire because they have thick bark. It's up to 12 inches thick. It protects the growing layer underneath. There are chemicals in the bark and in the wood that resist pests and decay, which is why redwood makes it such a great building material. And then the redwood canopy is very high. And so unless there are very long flame lengths, that canopy can persist unchanged. Redwoods also have the other half of that is resilience, which is the ability to come back after a disturbance. Redwoods are one of the very few conifers that can resprout, and they resprout both from buds that are on their stems that are released after fire and buds along the base that can create a whole new trunk, actually. And because they're living on those old root systems, they can rebound quite quickly. They don't have to germinate from seed and start from the beginning. They rebound from a system that already is capturing nutrients. And thus the redwoods can take advantage of any of the gaps in the forest and really grow quite quickly after a disturbance like fire. So redwoods really are programmed to come back after disturbance.
And how well or how badly were they damaged? How well did they survive this fire siege?
Well, that's going to be something we're still looking at. We know, again, that fire effects were different across different parts of the system. Certainly some of the greatest fire effects that I've seen so far have been in that headquarters area with some of the iconic redwoods. And there the flame lengths were as tall as the trees. But we know from other studies of fairly severe fires in redwoods, we'd expect something like 90% of the redwoods to come back. Mm. Now, they may look, some of them may look very odd when they first come back. A lot of them, interestingly, lost their tops, I think, in the winds that accompanied the firestorm through the most severe area. Now, that's also a natural occurrence. That happens for other reasons. But that will, well, for one thing, it'll make some of our tall trees shorter, at least for a while. But it does create an interesting complexity in the forest. And having those reiterated tops can actually make habitat for some of the plants and animals that live in those tree tops. So some of them will look different. The ones that are resprouting, one scientist described them as looking like green pipe cleaners. And that might go on for a while. But we do expect, on the whole, that the vast majority of the redwoods, individual redwoods, will survive. And where they don't, where the stem or the tree that you see dies, we expect that the root systems will keep living, and we'll see resprouts coming up from those root systems.
Okay, well, we look forward to being able to get back to the Big Basin Park. Joanne Kerbavaz is the Senior Environmental Scientist with California State Parks Santa Cruz District. Joanne, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much, and we look forward to inviting you all back to Big Basin.
Fair enough. All right, now let's turn to a different kind of tree. California is a big place, and every region has its iconic tree. Those include, of course, those reds we were just talking about of the North Coasts. Southern California has adopted the fan palm. There's a wide range of oak trees that scream Central Valley, and the Sierra Nevada mountains are covered with pines. Out in the desert, where everything is just a bit different, there's the Joshua tree, which really isn't a tree at all, but it is treasured. And later this month, it could get protection under the state's Endangered Species Act, in part because it's threatened by climate change. But what started as a seemingly simple act has gotten complicated. Brendan Cummings is the conservation director for the Center of Biological Diversity, and he's the author of the current effort to get the Joshua tree listed. And he is joining us as well by Zoom, if I understand. Brendan, how are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for being here. So before we talk about the details of it, I just said they weren't Joshua trees aren't actually a tree. Could you explain a little bit more about what they actually are and what they look like?
Yeah, if you talk to botanists, they'll debate what are they a tree or are they not? And they're not a tree in the typical sense in that they don't have a hardwood, they don't have growth rings, but they grow in a tree-like shape. And I call them a tree. They're as much a tree as a palm tree is a tree. Joshua trees, when we talk about Joshua trees, one thing we have to recognize is there's actually two types of Joshua trees in the world and in California. There's a Western tree, which tends to look more like a tree. Those are the trees we have in Joshua Tree National Park. They have more of a singular trunk that then branches out in this sort of Susian chaotic shape. And then we have an Eastern tree, which looks similar, but tends to be have less of a singular trunk and more branching up from the bottom. And that images of that may be more of what lead people to say they're not really a tree.
You're right. They do look like a tree married a cactus. And they really have that the spiky tops. And they are something unusual. Are they only found in the desert?
Broadly speaking, yes. Yeah. So Joshua trees, if you look at them as a singular entity, occur across four states in the Southwest. The Western species, which is the one we're trying to protect, is predominantly in California. It occurs in Joshua Tree National Park, and then across the backside of the San Bernardino, San Gabriel Mountains into the Antelope Valley, and then up along the eastern slopes, the desert slopes of the Sierra Nevada.
Okay, so can you talk a little about why that you feel they belong on the Endangered Species Act?
Yeah, the primary threat to Joshua trees is climate change. When we look at the Joshua trees that are on the landscape today, the adult trees you see today were recruited into the population under a climate that on average was about 1 degree Celsius cooler. If you then look at the population of young trees, the juvenile trees, they occupy about half that area. In other words, even if we were to magically stop global warming today and have no further warming at all, as the current adult trees die off, age out and die off, and are replaced by the juvenile trees, the range of the species would be diminished by about half. We lose half our Joshua trees, even under current conditions. But of course, it's going to get much worse. Even under the best global climate scenarios, it's going to get a lot hotter over the coming decades. If we stick with current emissions trajectories, we essentially lose all of our Joshua trees. Their entire habitat becomes unsuitable for reproduction. If we can keep it to some mid-level warming scenario, we're likely to lose 75 to 80% of our Joshua trees. And that's just the threat from climate. But overlaid on top of that, we have the threat that's a threat to many other things of increasing fire. Unlike, say, the redwood forests you've heard about, the Mojave Desert is not a fire-adapted landscape, and Joshua trees are not fire-resilient. But the desert has changed. Over the past 3 or 4 decades, invasive grasses have spread throughout the Mojave Desert and have changed the fire regime. In years past, a lightning strike might set one Joshua tree on fire, maybe burn a couple shrubs next to it, and that would be that. The fire would be less than an acre. Now, a lightning strike will hit a Joshua tree, set the tree on fire, that will set the grass below it on fire, which will carry it to the next tree, and the next tree, and the next tree. And you can have fires that cover thousands, tens of thousands of acres. And that's happened this year as the largest Joshua tree forest in California was largely destroyed by fire last month.
So what is where's the status of this petition, I guess, to get it on the Endangered Species Act, and why has it gotten complicated?
Yeah, the process to protect a species is ultimately made by the California Fish and Game Commission, which is five commissioners that are politically appointed. There's also an agency, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, which is the expert scientific agency. And in response to our petition, the department, the scientists, recommended that it advance to the next step and gain protection. But as word of that got out and the repercussions of listing started to become more known to those who wish to develop land that has Joshua trees on it, opposition arose. So one of the things with Joshua trees, we think of Joshua Tree National Park as a protected area, and it is from development, although not from climate change and fire. But a large chunk of the range of the Joshua tree is on non-federal land, on private land, on unprotected land. And there are numerous activities that, you know, happen on a regular basis where Joshua tree forests are mowed down to make way for parking lots and strip malls, housing developments, and in one of those unfortunate ironies, including large-scale renewable energy projects. So we have this weird tension in the California desert where, because of the great solar potential and because of the sort of social construct of the desert as a blank space, there's this rush to put large-scale renewable energy projects in the desert. And that could be a good thing. And we need to get to 100% renewable energy as soon as possible to save not just Joshua trees, but all of us. But unfortunately, the economic system, the regulatory system, the profit-driven utility system we operate under drives these large-scale projects often to intact Joshua tree forests. And if you think about it, if you have to cut down a forest of a climate-threatened tree to put in a renewable energy project, you're probably putting it in the wrong place. And so the listing effort, if the commission votes in a couple of weeks' time to protect the Joshua tree, it means that the current regime where you can cut down Joshua trees with essential legal impunity will change, and we'll have to have more rigorous planning, a permitting system that ideally will steer these projects to better places.
So Brandon, which is not uncommon, is a conflict of a whole lot of forces. One of them is probably economic development. Certainly, now, as you talked about, it's ironically clean energy. Is there a compromise? And we only have another minute or two, if you don't mind. So, but is there a compromise that some of that development can occur and you can still get some protection?
Yes, ultimately, you know, with regional planning, with wise planning, things can go forward. There's 250 species already protected under the California Endangered Species Act, yet we still have the fifth largest economy on the planet. Protecting endangered species and a thriving economy and large-scale development projects, including renewable projects, can coexist. The key is how you do them and where you put them. And also, if the impacts are unavoidable, what do you do to compensate for that? And that we're hoping to partially resolve in the coming weeks before the vote so that the Joshua tree listing doesn't act as a barrier to some of these projects getting built. But in the long term, we develop a more comprehensive conservation plan for the high desert that will work not just to save the Joshua tree, but also to ensure that any development that does happen in the high desert is done in a way that's sustainable in the long term, particularly in the face of the very much hotter few decades ahead of us.
Okay. Well, the California Fish and Game Commission will be voting later this month. We'll keep an eye on that. And Brendan Cummins is the Conservation Director for the Center for Biological Diversity. Brendan, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Up next, a modernization project at the Capitol could mean the loss of hundreds of trees. You're listening to Insight on Capitol Public Radio. Stay with us.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Capitol Public Radio. I'm Rick Cushman, sitting in for Randall White. There are plans in the works to modernize the state capitol annex, which include putting in needed underground parking. And later today, the Joint Rules Committee will hold a public hearing with the latest updates on the annex project. Some people have argued that the project hasn't had enough public input. Some say that too many historic trees on the Capitol grounds would need to be sacrificed. One of those people is Paula Pepper. She's a retired urban ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service. She joins us today to explain her pushback against the annex project. Paula, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Rick. Good morning.
So maybe the first and simplest question is, I mean, the annex is, people have been talking about the annex needing modernization for a very long time. Are you arguing against that?
Absolutely not. We know that the annex is unsafe as it is, but our argument is really against kind of the secrecy behind the whole project. Four bills were passed that provided CEQA relief, greatly reduced the ability to contest in court, insulated the project from future budget uncertainty. There are just, there are many more ways to go about this and have the public know a lot more about it.
And how will that affect the cause that you're talking about, was if there is more public input, the impact on the trees?
Well, you know, there is, for legal documents that are actually out, there are only two draft environmental impact reports. And most people were not even privy to those. And I think public input about where the underground parking garage is going to go, which would be right now, according to the DEIRs, close to 2 acres in size. The Underground Visitor Center will compromise the Deodar Cedars up front. There are a lot of trees. We really need to know what landscape plan is there.
So you're saying that you're not even sure which trees might be endangered?
No, I mean, there are, according to the DEIR, there are close to 100 trees within the footprint of the construction given on that. And so of those, we know there are the Deodar Cedars, there's Cockspur Coral, there are quite a few rare trees and memorial trees. And they say 20 to 30 trees will be removed. We don't know which ones. Which ones? People should know.
So for folks that aren't familiar with the Capitol grounds that well, that much, or where you're talking about, could you describe what part of the Capitol is and what those trees look like?
Yes, this is the four blocks that actually completely surround the Capitol. The park itself, this does not include from 12th Street down to 15th Street.
Which is the park.
We're just talking about, right. Yes. But what's interesting about that is there are already many fewer trees surrounding the Capitol. So we're concerned, especially with air quality issues and carbon storage, all that, that, you know, removing 20 to 30 trees is going to have an impact. what will happen with the rest of the trees. They have to be removed before excavation.
What, why have we lost other trees around the Capitol?
The biggest reason since 2014 has been the drought. And Governor Brown mandated that we had, use the park as an example. So cut back water. And the conifers in particular could not handle that. We lost 10% of the conifers with the drought. But mostly, you know, there has not been a tree management plan or a park management plan ever, not since 1878. And, the legislature needs to finally approve the Historic State Capitol Commission to do that.
So I'm going to diverge just a minute and spend a little more time on the trees around the Capitol and in our city in general, because that's, you know, as an urban ecologist, I imagine you're somewhat familiar with them. You know, you were talking about drought and that came up in our previous segment. What has the impact of drought been on the trees around the Capitol in that area of Sacramento?
It's been intense. They've had to call in a certified arborist to take a look to reduce a lot of the risk associated with the trees, because drought will kill off parts of trees. It may kill the entire tree. So an example is those deodar cedars that front the Capitol. Massive work has been done on those to make them safe for the public. Trees are hugely impacted by drought, but in a lot of different ways. But really, if you look at it, it's the root systems that matter and that they get enough water. And over the entire park, they just didn't quite get enough water.
So is there a coming back from that? Can they be restored? Or are they going to be vulnerable?
Absolutely. In fact, Mike Nilsson, who supervises park grounds and the UC Davis Arboretum, and myself have gathered together to start a program that will fund and start propagating new trees, replacement trees. There are 210 species of trees in Capitol Park, 97 of which only have one representative, and most of those are very old. So you need to plan starting 10 to 15 years ahead of time, because so many of the trees are rare enough that you need to find the seed source, which is an effort, and then to propagate each species.
And then how long does
UC Davis Arboretum is willing to hold the trees for up to 10 years for us.
And then how long would it take some of those trees to become semi full size trees?
Depends on the species, of course. But if you take the moon tree, which is slated for removal with the annex development, that tree, it'll take another 70 years or 50 years, I guess. It was planted in 71. So it'll take another 50 years for a tree to grow to its size.
My apologies. What's a moon tree?
The moon tree is the seed was transported to the moon with Apollo.
Oh.
And then it came back, and there are 10 existing redwood moon trees left. And this removal, they're hoping to propagate a new one from cuttings.
Wow. I did not know that. That's interesting. All right. So back to this project. Is the argument about losing trees, has that gained any resonance at all? Is there anybody supporting you?
Yes, we have, with the Public Accountability for our Capitol, a large coalition, along with heading towards 4,000 people who have signed our petition, but Sacramento Preservation, the California Urban Forestry Council, Sac Valley Group, Trees for Sacramento, Sacramento Tree Foundation, lots of people are supporting this. And not just for the trees, but to look at a true plan that, the whole public can see and decide whether we really need that, given we're already $54 billion in the hole with COVID, fires, huge issues of social justice. And $1.3 billion plus interest for this building and the swing building that everybody's going to move into during construction is not a pittance to all of us who've lost our jobs and our businesses.
And has your argument gotten any traction at the Capitol?
No. We've contacted lots of legislators. We've been told repeatedly, essentially, that this is the Joint Rules Chairman Ken Cooley's baby. And it wasn't until my webinar last week that we saw any changes on the Capitol side, even. I mean, nobody will talk to us. People are under non-disclosure agreements. That's the reason that...
Non-disclosure agreements for a capital project?
Yes. Yes. You know, people won't share with us. And that was part of the problem with the Historic State Capitol Commission that Dick Cowan and I resigned from in protest, because we could not learn about what was going on. Anybody who came to the meeting could not give us details, let alone details about the costs or whether all the options that were listed in Senate Bill 836 were ever pursued. And those options included the restoration, rehabilitation, renovation, or reconstruction of the annex, which is an historical building.
So what do you expect to learn today at the hearing?
Well, they finally, last evening at 5 p.m., posted the agenda. And it's about 137 pages long. And it showed three new designs that were never shown in the draft environmental impact reports. So the public should listen to that, watch it, and they can also speak up about it. I think it's interesting that they've gone ahead and done all this. The visitor center will be the first, apparently, to be developed. But really, we've contacted just about every media group for months, and you're the first ones, other than the Sacramento Bee, which has had some coverage, who've covered this to get it out to the public.
So this is a hearing today. Is there a vote scheduled some point in the future? Do you have any idea when they're looking at finalizing plans?
We don't. There is not a vote scheduled for today, but they need a vote soon on the three plans that are submitted. And they're significantly different than many of the things that were presented to the Historic State Capitol Commission.
And do they all affect trees the same?
No, they don't. But I honestly have not had time. You know, they affect trees in different locations because they're moving some of the underground parking structure, the visitor center, around a bit. So I'd have to take a look at that. But I know with one of the designs where the parking structure would be under what is 12th Street today, that would then impact, because of the 50-foot perimeter for construction purposes, that would impact the Civil War Memorial Grove, of which only 8 trees are left, plus some huge old trees. Okay. So we will see.
Okay. Well, we will keep an eye on this as much as possible. I hate to be giving an assignment to our Capitol Bureau. They know what they're doing, and I really don't. But Paula, thank you very much for your time this morning. Paula Pepper is a retired urban ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We have more information about this and all our guests on our website, which is capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. A special thank you to Randall White for putting the majority of this show together. I'm Rick Cushman sitting in for Randall with producers Kyle McKinnon and Cynthia Lopez. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Anthony Munoz. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian, and Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And as always, thank you for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.